and I teach religion and literature there. I've gotten more and more interested in autobiographies in the last few years, particularly multicultural autobiographies by African Americans and Native Americans. And I'm just starting to get more interested in autobiographies by women. So I'm going to be leading four discussions on spiritual autobiographies by women. And before I get into the particular book that's the focus today, I thought I'd just make a few sort of introductory remarks about what I see spirituality as, or what kind of holds these sessions together. Spirituality is a word that is kind of hard to define. There are a lot of books in the bookstore on spirituality. They all propose a different definition. And I'm not sure if I want to exactly define it, because I think it means something different for each of the writers I'll be talking about. But when people use the word spirituality, I think they're trying to say something different from talking about religion or piety or devotion. And I suggest that there are four qualities of spirituality that we'll see in the books we're going to talk about. First of all, when I think about spirituality, I think the authors are often not so much proposing answers as seeking. There's a quality of searching or exploring or discovery in spirituality that's very different from a lot of, quote, religious literature, where the works often get preachy or didactic, or this is the truth and you should accept my version of it. Spirituality, in my mind, is more tentative, more exploratory, and to me more interesting, in that the literature itself expresses the quality of searching. Secondly, there's a strongly individual character to these writings. The author's religiousness is not defined primarily by membership in a community. I think all these women are looking for community, but it's not just the church, or it's not anything that's easy for them to define. They're kind of going on their own individual way. And so in that individualistic quality, which maybe goes with the searching, there's something distinctively different from works which are claiming to represent a group, a community, a church. The third quality of spirituality is, I see in these works, a strong emphasis not on belief, dogma, doctrines, intellectual ideas, but on experience, feeling. There's a strong experiential element in which, and somewhat of a reaction against maybe a common understanding of what religion is all about as, I believe this, I believe that. Well, belief is important, but there's some other important aspects of spirituality that these women will be exploring. And the last quality, the fourth quality of spirituality I see in all these works is, I'm not quite sure what to call it, but we'll start with the idea that they're anti-dualistic. That is, I think all these women have grown up in some form of Christian community in which religion was separated from the rest of life. The sacred and the profane, the holy and ordinary experience, and they're all reacting against that. They're saying that divides life in half, and the religion is over there, or it's otherworldly, or it's what you do on Sunday, or it's what you do with certain people. And to them, I think that doesn't permeate all of life enough. And so they're all in different ways trying to recover a sense of the sacred or the holy in all of their lives. And we'll see how that works as we go along. In a way, that makes what spirituality is kind of nebulous, kind of vague. Martin Marty the other day sort of dismissed, I thought, a lot of spirituality as nebulous and vague, and, you know, if it's just somebody kind of having a little tingling, that counts as spirituality. And for him, that wasn't, you know, that wasn't defined enough. And I see the point there, but the women that we'll be talking about, I think, are wanting to say you can't always clearly distinguish the religious from our ordinary life. Any object in the world, any human being that you encounter, any experience that you have may be revelatory, to use religious language. So there is something kind of vague and murky about spirituality, but that's interesting. The lines blur. There are many forms of spirituality. There's Christian spirituality. There's New Age spirituality. There are whole sections of bookstores on spirituality. The women that I'll be looking at are all, I think, like myself, that's why I've perhaps chosen these particular people, coming out of a Christian tradition and yet not completely happy with it, and wanting to reappropriate or claim parts of their past, but to pick and choose. You know, they're not wanting to say you have to believe every doctrine you were taught in your Catholic upbringing or every line of the Bible. They're wanting to pick and choose, and they're not wanting to be limited by Christianity. Christianity is important. Maybe it's even the primary tradition they look to, but they don't want to be exclusive. And I guess personally, that's where I'm at. And so I like the way that they critically assess the Christian tradition they're coming from. Well, why women? They're all, first of all, these four writers, Patricia Hampel, Kathleen Norris, Terry Tempest Williams, and China Galland, are all very powerful, in my mind, writers. These books are all just a year or two old, fairly hot off the press. And they're all, first of all, they're good writers. And they have a lot to say that doesn't have anything to do with gender. In Malcolm X's autobiography, there's, I think, a powerful paragraph where he says how incredibly racist it is when the media would only ask him to talk about race. He says, you know, African Americans might have ideas about the space program. How incredibly racist it is if a person is only asked to talk about their race. Well, in the same way, I'm not just looking for gender issues here. Patricia Hampel has some powerful things to say about prayer that may not have anything to do at all with her, with gender. So I'll be exploring some just important spiritual ideas, but I'm also very interested in the difference gender makes. Feminists have taught us, or at least taught me, that our religious experience is profoundly shaped by our gender. And I'll be exploring in each of these works at least one way in which gender makes a difference. I think personally that men have a lot to learn from women, not only about prayer or spirituality, but about the ways our gender influences us all. Okay, so Patricia Hampel, Virgin Time, written in 1992. It's not in paperback yet, unfortunately. You can't be both up to date and economical in your choice of books, I guess. It's a book that that describes basically her three experiences of pilgrimage to Assisi in Italy and Lourdes in France, and to a retreat center in Northern California. And it's a very rich book. I'm just focusing on one of a zillion things I could have talked about, namely her ideas about prayer. So this is not an attempt to cover the waterfront, but an attempt to give some focus to a very rich book. It's also, I think, the most difficult of the four books I'm going to be talking about. And I hope there are passages that I'm going to read. I'm going to spend a lot of this time just reading some significant passages to give you a flavor for it, and then commenting on what I think is interesting. But don't worry if you don't completely get it. Don't give up. Come back another day. I think this is the hardest of the books that I'm going to be talking about, but it's the one that got me interested in women's autobiographies in particular. The epigraph is significant, from Emily Dickinson. Wonder is not precisely knowing, and not precisely knowing not. A beautiful but bleak condition. He has not lived who has not felt. An important quote getting at the way that the experience of wonder both involves knowing and not knowing. And it's, I think that epigraph we'll see very applicable to her ideas about prayer, that the element of not knowing, not completely understanding, is important to prayer. Maybe it's also important to the experience of this book, because there's some parts I'll read that I'm not sure I completely get it. Okay, so let me just sort of organize this in terms of three passages I'm going to read on prayer. And the central theme, I guess, for the day is that prayer involves imagination. I think often we think of prayer as the recital of beliefs or something that we've been handed. And we'll see how, for Hampel, prayer is most centrally perhaps an act of the imagination. Let me just start out with a reading from the first chapter, in which she's on the airplane to Assisi, and she's terrified of flying. And there's an interesting description of how she's sitting on the plane. I'm in all these quotes, I'm kind of ripping a few paragraphs out of a larger context, which is too bad, but I have to do it for the sake of time. Let me just start reading here. She's on the plane. She's playing in her hands with what she calls a totem, a little brooch, a sort of a good luck piece that someone has given her, which is a little 1 inch long or something piece, replica of a plane, a DC-3. And she's kind of playing with that in her hands and sweating and tense and nervous. And she starts remembering a story about where this brooch came from, which was from someone who played golf with Betty Grable. And she starts in her sort of anxiety on the brink of terror, starts sort of talking to herself. So I'll start to read here. I rub Howard Hughes' plane in a rhythm of safety known only to my terror. I repeat silently in a brainless mantra, played golf with Grable, golf with Grable, golf with Grable. The green dome of the toy cathedral is gone. The river is a flick of light, and we're just piercing the cloud cover, entering our climb. We may be experiencing a little turbulence, ladies and gentlemen, the captain is saying in that commander of the ship drawl they all seem to have. He advises us to keep our seat belts secured, as he does. We'll get above this stuff and find us a nice, smooth ride on out to the New York area. Smooth, smooth, the drawl of doom. St. Paul is gone, all my life in its streets, and we are experiencing turbulence. The West Point cadet, this is the person sitting next to her, has his face up against the window. I rub the DC-3 and repeat my mantra silently. Golf, 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 golf. I must be praying, proving once again without meaning to, that there's no stopping the mind's grab for salvation. O ye of little faith, O all of us on the go, who hardly know what we believe in anymore. Most of the time, I'm so removed from belief that I confuse it with having an opinion, as if God were a candidate who may or may not get the vote of my focus group. Then this other thing lunges from its corner, not fear, but the stunning acuity born of fear. How keen the terrified mind is. Its cry is prayer. Planes are my foxhole. I'm always on my knees in them. But just yesterday, I was sitting in the cool, shadowy parlor of San Damiano Monastery outside Minneapolis, visiting Donnie, Sister Mary Madonna. But we're beyond that now, after months, years now of my weekly visits. I was trying to explain to her why I was going on this trip, looking for something. Couldn't explain. "You're going on a pilgrimage," she said, meaning to be helpful. "No," I said, bristling. "I'm just going." Something about the word set my teeth on edge. Pilgrimage. I wince at the eau de cologne language of spirituality. But the whole world, as I first understood it, comes rushing back on the merest scent. I still want to embrace it. So, when it dares to draw close, I slap it clean across the mouth. Love and loathing, those old partners. Mine was a Catholic girlhood, spent gorging on metaphor. Mystical body, transubstantiation, dark night of the soul. The little martyrdom of everyday life. And remember, girls, life is a journey. Your own life is a pilgrimage. Maybe we had too much meaning too early. It was like having too much money. The quirkiness of life was betrayed, given inflated significance by our rich symbology. We powered around our ordinary lives in the Cadillac language of Catholic spirituality, looking on with pity as the Protestants pedaled their stripped-down bicycles. Nothing was just itself. Nothing was left alone. We were clasped, suffocating and yet happy, to the great bosom of meaning, with a capital M, which doesn't let me off the hook for snapping at Donnie. She carries it all lightly, as in a day pack, while I could barely lift my trunkful of Catholic memorabilia. "I don't know why I'm going," I told her finally. "Yes," she said, in that interested way of hers, "not knowing. That's the spiritual part." Donnie's over 50. Looks younger, except for the eyes. Her hair is shaped in what used to be called a pixie cut, a sort of monastic tonsure without the bald spot. It suits her. There is an elfin quality to her, a tough elf. She's been a contemplative nun since she was 17. Not a woman easily rattled. No doubt she sees my grouchiness as the spiritual part. I can't figure her. Yet I keep going back to visit her, to sort out what I thought was the past, my dead Catholic past, only to find it isn't dead at all. "It's called spiritual direction, what we're doing," she said one day. "Do you mind?" She's sympathetic to my language foibles. What could I say? Whatever we were doing, I found I required it, though I frown at the terms, spiritual direction. Pilgrimage. The plane heaves and climbs. It's struggling. Doesn't anyone else sense this? I'm being asked what I want to drink. I'm taking the foil pack of peanuts. I'm the only one dying. Beads of water sweat across the window. I can't see a thing. Golf, golf, golf. God, God. Don't worry, Donnie said yesterday. I'll be in the chapel praying for you. I'll hold you up there all the way across the ocean. She laughed, a nutty druid laugh, Irish and ironic. The laugh made me almost believe her. Maybe that's faith, the smart little laugh that holds the world up. The plane lurches and seethes. I'm a goner, and Donnie is safe on the ground, praying into the sky. Look, the skinhead cadet has turned his moon face to me, and now he points out the window. We're still tipped slightly upward, still laboring through the wads of wet gray cotton. The plane, surging and unsettled, penetrates the cloud batten in awful lurches. And there, just crowning, the blue arc of the sky emerges, brittle with the sun's gold. The cadet is gleaming too, blind with wonder as we hurtle into heaven. And one more paragraph towards the end of this chapter. People like me, fused by fascination to their past, find themselves taking planes to distant places, boarding with an urgency that suggests a family emergency is calling us home. Looking for our roots, we say. But roots are buried, they're supposed to be. And the past isn't alive, only our urgency is. Maybe this urgency is the past. The only juice still spurting from the source that made us. It must be this urgency, a peculiar form of desire that makes us zoom around looking for what time has put in its breast pocket. Okay, that's a part of the first chapter where she's just leaving for the pilgrimage to Assisi. And some of the things that I find interesting about this are, first of all, the way that, that sort of mantra, golf, 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 suddenly becomes God, God, God. As if she's trying to show that, I mean, is saying God, 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 is that prayer? At least it's on the brink of prayer. And it's as if she's trying to show the way our prayers, I mean, maybe this is an obvious insight or something about all prayer, that it expresses where we're at, our daily life. But I like the way she shows almost psychologically where the source of the desire to pray comes from in this case, and where she's, one minute she's doing something that doesn't seem to have anything to do with prayer, and then there's this kind of very subtle transition, and suddenly she's saying God and calling on God to help her deal with her terror of flying. Prayer's continuity with our ordinary non-religious desires. An interesting thing coming out of this passage.
But she uses the word mantra pretty early on, and to me, you know, having been a student of the Eastern philosophies, that speaks to me of a direct, trying to directly connect with the divine. That other dimension.
So there is, before she's praying, she is doing something religious, something spiritual, looking for support on the way to prayer. Yeah. Please do feel free to interrupt me at any point. Don't even interrupt me, just talk. Because I'm very interested in other people's responses to these passages.
Well, listening to this, it got me thinking about superstition.
Mm-hmm.
Where that plays, or what you might think that you know, people, especially on planes, they have a lot of superstitions about if I do this a certain way, I'm going to make it. And there's somehow a connection with something other than yourself. mm-hmm. to help you along the way. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. I think growing up, superstition was something very different from the church and mm-hmm. prayer and that, but it seems to be able to have some similarities.
Yeah. They're both looking for some kind of an interesting question, then what is the difference between superstition in the negative sense? And I mean, we can see other people's religions as superstitions. I'm sure they would see our, superstition is what Westerners call, the aboriginal religions of the world. It's what Protestants see Catholics doing with their, with their ritual objects. Superstition is somebody else's religion. That's an interesting thing. In this passage also, I'm struck by her ambivalence about her own Catholic past. And that's a very important theme in the book. I mean, the language, she sees herself doing something religious, but when she thinks of the words that she grew up on as a girl, spirituality, pilgrimage, the little martyrdom of daily life, it's like she wants to get away from that in some ways too. At least in the past, she has rebelled against her past. I think in a way all of these books, I mean, as I think now in retrospect about why I chose these books and the way it reflects something autobiographical about me, an important theme is the necessity of rebelling against your upbringing at a certain stage of becoming an adult and coming back to that as an adult in a more mature way, being able to appreciate. You had to go through that stage of rebellion to make an adult acceptance of it, an adult commitment to it that wasn't more than just, doing what you were told. Hampel is coming back in this book to kind of her Catholic past as she reinterprets it imaginatively. I think this passage essentially illustrates also the qualities of the spirituality I talked about at the beginning, the individual nature, the searching. She's going to Italy and she doesn't even exactly know what she's looking for, but she feels it's somehow connected with finding her own identity. The emotion, quality of fear, central to the religious experience in this passage. And as I said before, the way everyday life, terror on an airplane, blurs into something that's at least beginning to look like a religious experience. The last passage there that I read too, where she talks about the past isn't alive, only the urgency that we feel to understand the meaning of the past, this aspect of it and not that aspect of it, is to me a very profound statement about autobiography also. That really, autobiographies aren't about the past. They're about the present. They're about the writer in the present trying to understand, in this case, her girlhood, or something that happened to them then, but it's the quality of searching in the present for meaning that animates, that makes alive autobiography. So another theme that I've actually written a couple books about, but just want to allude to briefly here, is the notion that autobiography itself is a religious quest. It's not simply history. It's not about a long ago past. It's an urgent present day necessity to figure out what in the hell my life means now. Let me quickly read a second group of shorter passages which all have to do with prayer. I've kind of excerpted a number of ideas or reflections of Hampel's about prayer, which I think are interesting. Someone asks her if she believes in God, and she says, "Will asked a question, do you believe in God? It wasn't my question. Time magazine, too, had broken the wrong story all those years ago when it published its famous God is Dead cover. God was not at stake. Prayer was the fatality. Prayer was dead. This was what I could not accept. God exists or not remains forever a fascination. But God, believed in or not, remains only the elected official for the colossal job of mystery. To my mind, prayer was the real question. For prayer exists. No question about that. It is the peculiarly human response to the fact of this endless mystery of bliss and brutality, impersonal might and lyric intimacy that composes our experience of life. As the human response to this mystery, prayer, not the existence of God, is the thing to be decided. But silence was the first prayer I learned to trust when I began my visits to San Damiano. Only later did I begin to let the words in. The silence of the chapel at prayer was broken only by a habit of praise that I came to see was so primal it was not exactly or not only human. It was, or it mimicked exactly, the essential utterance of existence. It rose from the raw passion which rules life, an urge which has no voice but craves articulation. This communal prayer voiced a harmony otherwise elusive in all of creation, yet thrumming in the monastic silence. On the other hand, the self, my own and everyone else's, had always struck me as being nothing but voice, all scream and whimper, demand and tease and coax. We want, we want, we want. Most of the time we cannot help but obey the commands of the self. We are human and inevitably remain loyal to ourselves. But the psalms and canticles I saw expressed some other allegiance as well. In the scroll of the, this she's quoting something here now, a psalm, I think. In the scroll of the book it is written of me, my delight is to do your will. Your law, my God, is deep in my heart. The silence, end of quote, the silence and the psalms had equal value for those moments in the chapel. They put things in correct register, as printers say, of perfect press work, when all the text is lined up straight and true back in front. The silence was God. The psalms were us. All of us, it seemed to me. End of Hample quote. And to me, an interesting passage because the act of prayer in this passage, to me, seems to be an act of silence. And she's sort of saying that the words that we're so often saying are, it seems sort of egotistic or just wanting, demanding, God do this, God do that. And she has a moment when true prayer seems to her to be being silent in the face of mystery, simply putting yourself in the presence of ultimate mystery and shutting up, not only the words out loud, but maybe even the words in your mind, just shutting up. The silence is important. And it seems to me here that imagination of what is totally other is what prayer is about. Not I mean, it's also articulation of the needs of the self and concern for others. That's also a kind of prayer. But prayer is also simply awe, wonder, and imagination of the final mystery. If you've ever had an experience, a worship experience, where silence was an important part of it, it can be very powerful. Silence alone doesn't do it for me so much sometimes as words punctuated by silence, or silence punctuated by words. Interesting. The use of silence as it might be related to imagination. Any other thoughts on that?
Well, I was thinking just the theme that they're using here this summer, which is listen to the sacred.
Yeah.
Rather than
talk to it.
Talk to it or pray.
Yeah.
I've talked in a bunch of my workshops about the importance to me of silence, and how hard, in the context of a graduate program or a city like Washington, D.C., or, you know, the lives that so many of us lead, how hard it is to hear. Because you never are alone. And that I was finding the only time I could write was between midnight and 4 a.m, because the phone wasn't going to ring, because I couldn't go grocery shopping, because nothing was going to happen in that span of time to interrupt silence. And I found it interesting, but also sort of horrible, because the only time then that I could be creative was when I was exhausted between midnight and 4. I think the word contemplation has to do with silence, I think, and temple, a space for the sacred in silence, in the presence of the spirit or the sacred, but not speaking.
Mm-hmm. In a lot of the Eastern mystical traditions, that's the first lesson. Is to just shut out all the other stimuli. And that's the hardest thing to do.
We had a forum here the other night about use of time, and this seems to me to and what Rebecca said seems to me to relate very much to that. How do you slow down enough, given most of our crazy lives, to make space for that silence and that contemplation? By the way, the subtitle of the book, I don't know if Rebecca, you knew it, you used the word contemplation. The subtitle is In Search of the Contemplative Life.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So you sort of intuited that that's an important dimension of prayer, contemplation. Thank you for both those comments. Let me go on and read one on how prayer is, what do I want to say? Well, I'll read it and then I'll comment. What is prayer? I made a list. Praise, gratitude, begging, pleading, and cutting deals. Please, God, if you just do this. Oh. Fruitless whining and puling. I don't know the word puling, but it doesn't sound very nice. And finally, focus. There the list breaks off. I had found my word. Prayer only looks like an act of language. Fundamentally, it is a position, a placement of oneself. Focus. Get there, and all that's left to say is the words. They come from ancient times. Hear the round of the Psalms, wheeling through the seasons endlessly in the office. I should interrupt and say she's in Northern California now at a monastic retreat. The words come from the surprisingly eloquent heart, from the gush and chatter of the day's detail, longing to be rendered. So what is silence? Silence speaks, the contemplatives say. But really, I think, silence sorts. An ordering instinct sends people into the hush where the voice can be heard. This is the sorting intelligence of poetry, marked by the unbroken certainty of rhythm, perfect pitch, the placing of things in right order as in metrical form. Not rigid categories, but the recognition of a shape always there, but ordinarily obscured by what? By noise, which is ourselves trying to do the sorting in an order that may be a heroic effort, but is bound to be a fantasy. Silence, that inspired dealer, takes the day's deck, the life, all in a crazy heap, lays it out, and plays its flawless hand of solitaire, every card in place, scoops them up, and does it all over again. And the dark night of the soul? Is the joker constantly turning up? It's in every hand. A little bit later. Working in the garden, I said to Thomas, really focuses the mind. This is a monk. Yes, he said, as if this were a new observation, it frees the mind. Focus, freedom, the same thing to him. Cecile the other night said, dogma, always a thorn. Dogma is only the expression of the deeper symbol. If it's treated as the thing that counts, it kills symbol. Just kills it dead. The assumption that symbol is alive, not a unit of fantasy, the only absolutely real thing, but frighteningly vulnerable, ever a potential murder victim, a life requiring protection, as any creature does. And Donnie one time, trying yet again to explain to me, it's when the church tries to tame the metaphors that we get in trouble. You can't control the images. That's not what they're there for. You have to get in there with them. So that's what monastic life is, after all. And its core element, prayer, both so devoted to symbol. They aren't poetic. They are poetry itself. Not in a decorative sense, not even having to do with an aesthetic experience. Rather, like poetry, monastic life seizes upon daily life and renders it as symbol, attuned to season, to hour, to the cycle on which our lives depend. The praying monastery as life within poetry. Or say it this way, to become the lines and white space of a poem. That's what the divine office is, after all. Time reckoned as poetry, hours made into verses, with the white space of silence, work, which is another kind of silence, and community in between the stanzas. They knew what they were doing, Thomas said, looking around the garden, when they got into agriculture. I'm going to stop there, but I'm struck in that passage by the importance of symbol, that prayer is a focus upon often a particular symbol, you know, the cross, the bread, the wine. Not necessarily a believing this or that about it, but a what contemplation of it or being there with it. Rebecca, I'm sure you could relate to the lines about poetry too, the interpretation of the monastic life as a kind of living an attempt at least to live the poet's consciousness or something like that. To live with that kind of vivid awareness of physical realities, sensuous realities.
To be struck me as the phrase that the church tries to tame metaphors.
Yeah.
Metaphors then are like wild beasts.
Yeah.
You know, kind of unpredictable.
Yeah.
And living.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, I shouldn't dump on theologians because they have an important place, but, my own experience of the study of theology is often like, all the juice is just gone. It's just head games or something, But that, why? That, in a way, that's such a weird thing. Why would people try to take the juice out of, the life out of
symbol? Well, that's where you started with the idea of wonder and being, what you don't know, and the whole search, academia gets so quickly involved in knowing it, which is important, but often does. Now, I've had over and over again in poetry workshops as people attempt to peel the poems apart and figure out what they mean, what this line meant. By the time the poor thing is lying there dead on the table, by the time you've done picking through it. And it remains a dilemma, how to, because it's not that you don't want to do that. It's not that you don't want to pay close attention and understand, but how to leave the wonder intact, how to be content with not knowing certain things.
But I don't think in general our culture accepts that or praises that.
Right.
We want to have the quick, the explanation and the reasons for it.
It's a control thing.
Yeah, partly. I think that because males have dominated academics and dominated to a large degree, much of society, that's the way maybe the male mind works more, wants to be rational, wants to be reasonable. Mm-hmm. And when you're out there, saying, well, we don't know, and let's just go with that, that's not respected, I don't think, as much.
Mm-hmm. It's maybe partly because it's scary. It's out of, you don't have control.
Sure.
If the symbol's meaning is not something all cut and dried, who knows what it's going to make you feel like?
Right.
And maybe the loss of control is an issue there. We domesticate the symbols.
I see where they drain the life out because it's the only place they can find life. Once they've taken life out of it, it's where they can exist. There comes their world. Then yes, they do have control. I'm speaking of the world of academia, theologians. I've always felt that they're taking the life out of so much because it's where they find life. And they turn around and make rules for the rest of the world, which must live.
Yeah. Leads into a discussion of theology. Some of my best friends are theologians, but I guess I too have some ambivalence sometimes about the way that they approach reality.
One
beast
off death, vultures do it all the time.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. 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 Yeah.
They're trying to describe the ineffable. And Patricia Hampel is sort of leaving maybe more room to move around to. Or she's staying with poetry or something. You're staying in that realm more. When you're there's a certain amount of anxiety in trying to describe it.
She's a juggler
out of it.
And she's asking more than she's telling, maybe. And we're used to wanting to be told.
Told what it means, yeah. Let me read two more passages. If contemplatives live the life of the gaze, which is the deepest prayer, then they must try to see it all. Prayer as focus is not a way of limiting what can be seen. It is a habit of attention brought to bear on all that is. And who is it we pray to here in the great gray chapel? the God who is, who was, and who will be for ages unending. Amen. The God inside and outside history. Thomas Merton had thoughts on the question of focus in prayer and how prayer fits with the reality of history and politics. Bob says, a quote from Merton at the ready in his notebook, this is quoting Thomas Merton, "The contemplative life must provide an area, a space of liberty, of silence, in which possibilities are allowed to surface and new choices beyond routine choice become manifest. It should create a new experience of time, not as stopgap stillness, but as, in French, temps vierge, virgin time. Not a blank to be filled or an untouched space to be conquered and violated, but a space which can enjoy its own potentialities and hopes and its own presence to itself, one's own time, but not dominated by one's ego and its demands. Hence, open to others, compassionate time, rooted in the sense of common illusion and in criticism of it." The end of both Merton and Hampel. I like the way in that passage, the act of prayer, which in some ways seems like, you know, there might be people off in their closet by themselves or something. In fact, most of this book is solitary prayer rather than communal. Has an ethical dimension in terms of the way Hampel talks about prayer as helping you to learn to focus your attention on everything, ideally, including most especially other people. And hence it's compassionate time. So that the act of, you know, this, that spirituality and politics and history and other people are in fact deeply, can be deeply connected through this kind of imagination of the other. That is what prayer should be about. To me, this also relates to the focus, to the forum we had last week where we were talking about time. And I see this passage as sort of implicitly talking about the need to be in the present moment again, as we said last week. Prayer as an utterly, as being present, being in the present moment, as things being present to you, the symbol of whatever it is that you're contemplating. And so prayer has, the right kind of prayer has a lot to do with learning to live in time the right way and not be elsewhere, being at lunch, being at where you were yesterday, being wherever it is. Prayer as a kind of learning to be in the present moment has a strong ethical component. Let me, the final passage I want to read has to do with this notion of virgin time, which I haven't completely figured out, but it's the one way that I want to talk about Hampel's being a woman as shaping her spirituality, and giving the title of virgin time, I think is interesting and significant. And in the passage I'm going to read, notice basically how her rejection of Catholicism for many years had to do with her becoming a woman and the way that was related to a kind of rejection of virginity, innocence, girlishness, you know, all those things that you kind of want to leave behind at a certain point in your life. And the way that, in what she says is her first, watch the way that her first real prayer. She's talked a lot about prayer, but in the passage I'm about to read, she says this is the first real prayer that she really offers herself. Notice how that's bound up with a kind of coming back to the symbol of virginity as something that has positive meaning to her. This is in Northern California. At dawn, she and some other, it's a women's retreat, and she and some other women get up at dawn. They gave us the readings for the day. The climb to the high meadow was steep, the grasses drenched with dew, and the sky pale and uncertain, the no weather of pre-dawn. It was the instant before things begin, the most receptive moment of the day. Merton's downbeat stroke, when he said, "The first chirps of the waking day, birds make the point vierge, the virgin time of the dawn, under a sky as yet without real light, a moment of awe and inexpressible innocence, timeless time, the receptive temporal pivot when being hangs suspended, unadorned by will or intention." And now she quotes Merton again. "For the birds, there is not a time that they tell," Merton wrote of this moment of the day, "but the virgin point between darkness and light, between non-being and being, when creation in its innocence asks permission to be once again, as it did on the first morning that ever was." End of Merton quote. Hampel continuing, "the virgin instant." He was writing of the contemplative signature moment, its icon, the virgin, a girl emerging at daybreak. We climbed into the frail light of this instant from the dirt road up the steep grassy slope. The sun, its great bald head, gold with a fontanelle of red, was just crowning across the ridge from us, eternally innocent, piercing our night eyes. That old monster, innocence. My ingenue life, which had been clutched even more fiercely in the stranglehold of willful Catholic naivete than James Joyce's furious Irish artist lads, who at least were boys and meant to break the rules. I had done everything I could think of to wrestle free, broke my parents' hearts, hardened my own, mixed it up every way I could, tried to be a furious artist myself. My methods had been many: sex as freedom, books as tactical missiles, the outward mobility away from the soul of intellectual life, passionate politics, and a string of wrong romances. I suited up in all the knightly armor I could find to ride against the convent school ingenue who refused to convert to the secular faith of the real world. Or maybe she was simply a failed pagan, incapable of forging a different self. In the end, who have I always been? Skipping to the last quote I'll read here. She's standing on the hillside, and this is what she says is her first prayer. "Now, all these years later, to stand on a hill at sunrise with a bunch of nuns who don't look like nuns, everybody wearing sweatshirts and big sweaters, my girlish fury burned, the embers still glowing, joining our light to the new sun of midsummer, midlife, to find a use for innocence, after all. Tears spiked my eyes. I can't help it. It's how I am. Like the hot metal of a linotype, these ordinary words cast themselves across my mind. The words could have been, Lord, have mercy, or forgive me, for I have sinned. They were those words, in fact, those prayerful words of old, but neatly camouflaged in my modern voice that can't resist ripping the religious art off the walls. I can't help it. It's how I am. Finally, prayer. After all my running away from it, and then running after it to Assisi in Lourdes. We had left ourselves during the most personal hour of all, the dark night of the soul and all its experience. It gave way at this virginal morning instant to the anonymous presence of being itself.